You're listening to Extract with your host, X, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Good Sunday evening, wherever you may be here on the West Coast, or morning on International. We're going international tonight, all the way from England, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening and welcome to the Truth Seeking Radio program for the Truth Seekers. Extract Radio. I'm the guy you call X. Extracting the truth from the global elite each and every Sunday night right here on LATalkRadio.com. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to tonight's program. Great show for tonight. Great guests. Sorry for the delay. Got held up here in L.A. Great program for tonight. We're going to go international tonight. As always, extracting the truth from the elite. Here on this place we call Extract Radio. On the home, we call L.A. Talk Radio. Of course, on the World Wide Web every Sunday night, 8 p.m. Pacific time. Apologize, ladies and gentlemen, for the lateness. Live radio, it happens. Great show for you tonight. I want to thank all the comments on extractradio.com, my new blog, The Blueprint of the Elite. Much respect to that. Check out all my latest blogs on www.extractradio.com. Email me anytime, extractradio@hotmail.com. We got two very special guests very early in the morning in England on hold. I want to get to them right away. Nigel Kerner is an author and freelance journalist. His formal graduate education is in biomedical science and human behavioral psychology. His fascination with the puzzling and enigmatic phenomenon of UFOs resulted in his first book, The Song of the Greys. This serious work on the subject is now noted worldwide for his radical view on the phenomenon. His latest book, Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, which we'll be discussing here tonight on Extract Radio, is the second in a trilogy about the UFO phenomenon and its social repercussions on humanity. His books and numerous articles have established his unique thesis as part of the canon of series literature on the subject. For more of Nigel's work, visit his website at www.nigelkerner.com. That's NigelKerner.com. As well, we have Dr. Andrew Silverman here tonight, a medical doctor who's been interested since childhood in the nature of what we are as human beings and what our potential is. He became aware of the Turin, Shroud of Turin, that is, seeing a life-song photographic print at Nigel Kerner's house. We're going to be talking to Dr. Andrew Silverman as well. First and foremost, gentlemen, I know it's very early in England. I want to thank you for being here at this time.
It's great to be with you.
Thank you, Nigel. Thank you. Do we have Dr. Andrew on as well?
Yeah, well, he's on there somewhere.
There he is. Hey, how's the weather in England today?
Well, absolutely terrible. Absolutely terrible. Gale force winds, and we've been driving down the motorway to our destination here with considerable trouble. But the fact is that the spirits are happy and we're raring to go.
Excellent. I thank you both, gentlemen, for being on so early. I know it's very early for you guys. Not early enough for breakfast, but late enough for a nightcap. Let's start with you, Nigel. Your book, Grey Aliens. Wow, very informative book, very lengthy book. I read it, and I'm very impressed with the work that you've done. Nigel, I always ask this of my guests, on how exactly what inspired them, what was their lifelong turning point that took them in the direction that they did. What exactly happened to you in your life, Nigel, to make you go to where you are in your life now, that is, in the work that you do?
Yeah, well, I come from a science-soaked background, and this UFO business was a very, very strange leap in the dark for me. It came to my attention through my young son, who at the time was 12 years old, when he asked me about whether this thing was in fact real, and there was some kind of reality to it. And I, of course, was tempted to poo-poo the idea because I was a complete skeptic about it at the time. And I thought, because my little boy then is now considerably older, but was rather hitched up well between his ears, so to speak, I wanted to give him a responsible answer to it. So I said, give me a rain check on this. Mm-hmm. And maybe 30-odd years later, I was able to tell him that not only is it real, but it's probably the most serious and threat to humankind that we could face an asteroid crashing on the planet. Yeah. And it's something that, in fact, turned all my perspectives, hitherto perspectives, upside down. And I had to alter a lot of my prejudices to their root as a result of this great adventure over 30 years of investigating this phenomenon. Turns out, when you connect up the dots, that the whole phenomenon is intricately woven into the entire psychological status of our species, and maybe it was responsible in the first place for the turning out of the modern genotype of humanity, Homo sapiens, many, many thousands of years ago. A very, very interesting roots. It's kind of inspired everything I think about and do in my life.
Yeah.
And a very, very serious subject. In fact, not frivolous at all. A long way from the old stories that we all came through, Buck Rogers and all the rest of that kind of, you know, space alien stuff. This is real business, X.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Nigel. Very, 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 very good point that you made. Your book, what I liked about it is you have a very interesting take. Now I must say to you, you probably do not know, but ufology and the study of UFOs is something that we do here at Extract Radio and we discuss, but it's not the only thing we do. And it is a major topic here. And I've had a lot of guests come on here with their books and articles and seminars that they've, you know, brought about. Same aspect as you have. But your take is very interesting and very different, which I really enjoyed reading your book. It's a very thorough book, a very lengthy book, as I said in my introduction. You talk about in your book, Nigel, the gray aliens, the grays, excuse me, being a final product of civilization. Tell our audience about that.
Well, you see, we look at the state we seem to be in a kind of global sociological quantums, shall we say. Mm-hmm. We seem to be kind of steadily moving towards, you know, the transformation of our natural humanity into an artificial version. Our progress, you know, towards what I call SIM card man, in quotes, mm-hmm. is accelerating. You know, I'm talking about the implantation of chips in the human body is gaining acceptance, be it for the enhancement of intelligence or memory or as a type of medical alert bracelet, perhaps implanted in our hand or our wrist. And slowly, it seems to me that the kind of and man shall walk as machine kind of thing seems to be going apace. Now, I don't want to say that I'm getting paranoid that tomorrow we'll all become robots. But, you know, when you look at the etiological situation of how we transform a living biology into one that is, shall we say, bionic, and, of course, we've all seen the bionic man and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The trouble with that is we seem to take this as something out there that isn't really personal to each and every one of us. But when you watch how we insidiously seem to be moving towards a situation that is, in fact, transforming the natural livingness of humanity, I think that's when we really need to stop a bit and ask questions about where we're actually heading. Now, in the news recently, there were reports that NASA and General Motors are just putting the finishing touches on a project to send robots into space with astronauts, you know? Yeah. And robots will eventually be left behind as caretakers to run long-term experiments. Well, could the gray aliens, and there is no doubt now with all the research I've read and all the people that I've spoken to in this context over 30, 35 to 40 years, not to put too fine a point on it, of dedicated research into this subject, it seems to me that these things that they call the greys are in fact a type of robotic, biological robot, and that they really are not a natural kind of species in terms of life and death and birth and all that kind of thing.
So you're saying that they're not, is that what you're saying? You're saying they're robotic in nature.
There's no question they're not. Okay. They're not actually a living species. They are in fact some kind of expression that, you know, rather like we send robots into space these days to try to find information of planets out there. Of course, you can imagine a civilization far in advance of us, because these things, after all, have got here through and past that speed of light business of Einstein.
Yep.
And that then asks a very big question of all of us. If such a capacity exists for these things, they would have to be, in technological terms at least, vastly superior to us. And that superiority is going to have a very, very telling expression in terms of our human aegis into the future. Now, can you imagine, if you look at the planet that we live on, we as human beings dominate this planet, and you know what happens to animals mm-hmm. through our domination. And in fact, every single genotype that has dominated another genotype has done it at the expense of the subservient one. And that is the real problem. Why is that so? And unquestionably, without fail, the dominance has been deleterious to that which is dominated, so to speak. Now, in the same terms of reference, can you imagine a programmed entity that comes here without the capacity for conscience, for, you know, all the qualities that we take to be natural, if you like? Can you imagine what that aegis is going to be in terms of our situation as being less than theirs in technological expertise? We are bound to be dominated. And I, through all the evidence that I have looked at over the years, I'm mm-hmm. absolutely convinced that these things are here not in terms of any kind of beneficence towards us. They are here, in fact, to provide the capacity for a hidden agenda that is theirs and theirs alone. And the very fact that they seem to be hiding so precociously amongst all of us, and the fact that they do everything possible to obscure their presence here, and the fact, indeed...
Nigel, you still there with us? We're going to try to get Nigel back on the air, ladies and gentlemen. There he is. Nigel, you still there with us?
Sorry. No, I'm...
Live radio, it's a wonderful thing, but sometimes things like this do happen. I tend to wonder, it happens on my show more than it should. I'd like to know the reason why. Nigel, Dr. Andrew Silverman, are you there? And here they are, of course. There you are, guys. Welcome back,
Hi.
Guys. How you guys
I'm
doing?
Hello.
It's okay. I wasn't sure if a gray alien took you or not. I had to make sure that you were still there. Nigel, let me ask you this. Now that you're back on the program, let me ask you this. If these grays are exactly robotic in nature, let's go with that theory, because it's an interesting theory, and it's one that I haven't heard, believe it or not. And I've heard them all.
Really?
When it comes. Yes, I have not heard it. They have to be programmed. Who is the programmer? Who's behind program? That's what I want to know.
We can see how the damage wrecked by technological progress and so on may eventually render our planet inhospitable to life. Okay, just surmise this. We can see also how the same technological progress leads to the scope for nuclear catastrophe on a world scale, and that could achieve that same end even faster. So let's say the same has happened in another planetary location, and their gophers, the greys, are then sent out into the universe to kind of, you know, reconstitute their life form, perhaps through cloning procedures elsewhere. You know, that they could attempt to hybridize with us so that they can, shall we say, survive our planet by merging species with one already adapted for the local conditions and, say, clone or reclone humanity in kind of hybrid mixtures with them. Now, these things are machines. They are programmed, and you cannot make a machine into a man. They come across a natural species. Now, the whole thing depends and pivots on this crucial difference between what is natural and what that really means, and also what is artificial and created and what that really means. So here we are, we've got a roboid. It's biological roboid, a synthetically created thing that in fact is difficult if they look like us, shall we say, to differentiate between us and them. But these things are quite clearly different looking to us and so forth. Yet they are, when they're looked at under the microscope, so to speak, in several parts of the world, there are secret documents that I've had access to and read about autopsies that were genuine, not the things they fake and put on TV and so on.
Of course.
These things have seemed to be some kind of made of some kind of gray mercury mulch with gold wires running through them and all kinds of things that are not organic, that are in fact clearly machine run and electronically kind of driven.
Well, let me ask you this. Well, let me ask you this.
Quantum computers, you know, they have quantum computers for processing information.
Absolutely. A lot of the abduction cases and when people describe grays, when they describe these beings, a lot of them get a sense of almost of an exorcism happening. These terrible things from the Benny and Barney Hill cases all the way up to even cases in England. I know in Liverpool, for instance, the cases that they describe are totally different looking beings from grays, and they leave an almost sulfur smell, very salty, almost like a demonic type of smell in the room. Yeah. From the cases that I've, how do you classify the differences, Nigel, between them and the ones we're talking about here right now?
Well, if you can have a primary, highly intelligent species that goes from different points in the universe, and they therefore do that, follow the same kind of principle. Let's see what this place is in terms of our benefit, shall we say. Then you can expect them to try to contrive some kind of mechanism where they can actually exist within that scope. So they may be producing different types of these types of being that are kind of, you know, in the local conditions, the best form of adaptation possible for them to try to fit into. And they would then look at all these things and measure these things up, make up facsimiles, if you like, at various places. I mean, you know, in the recent past, just maybe a couple of months ago, I think, looking back, they've come to the conclusion that the cosmologists that in our galaxy alone, there may well be over 100,000 Earth-like planets at a conservative estimate.
Yeah.
Now, that means we've got an awful lot of different types of living being there that may be naturally derived. In other words, the things that have come in with the universe. Now, you get somewhere in that particular number of things, you get a highly developed scenario where, you know, development has gone on for 10 to 20,000 years, shall we say. Mm-hmm. Our technological innovations are just 150 years, you know, almost 200 years since the first steam engine gave us the technological age, so to speak. And you can see what we've done in that space of time. So exponentially, it would be an incredible advance that these people, these things might have in terms of an advantage against us. Mm-hmm. Now, that then would mean that they'd be looking in the universe for things that are, if you like, commensurate with what their brief is or what their program is in that computer. And to do that, they would have to, as I say, contrive facsimile type mechanisms to match in with that program, so to speak. So recently, for instance, a senior astronomer at SETI, a chap called Seth Shostak, explains that having now looked for the signals for 50 years, SETI is going through a process of realizing, can you believe this, that the odds in favor of detecting signals from a sentient machine rather than biological life are far greater. Now, you know, these are highly intelligent people, and it takes them 50 years to see this simple, you know, correlation.
Absolutely.
And that's the really surprising thing, is why haven't we looked at this kind of mechanism, if it's here on the Earth, as something that might be a great threat to us, mm-hmm. rather than something that is beneficial? Because as you say, and yourself, the numbers of experiences through these abductions and so on is increasing, not decreasing.
No, it is. That's right. That is correct.
That is something that, you know, we have to look to. I think Andrew wants to make a point.
Absolutely. Here. I was going to ask Dr. Andrew Silverman. Good morning, first of all, and thank you for being on Extract Radio so early. Good morning to you, Dr. Andrew. I have a question for you, Dr. Andrew, if you don't mind. Well, in Nigel's book, Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, you have the Barry Schwartz's pictures of the Shroud of Turin. I had him on the show, Dr. Andrew, as a guest discussing the Shroud of Turin. He's doing a remarkable job. I'd like to know what, if any, Dr. Andrew, the correlation between the grays and the Shroud and the, you know, what exactly you are trying to explain in the book here. I'd like the audience would like to know exactly what the correlation is between the two.
Well, I think what Nigel's trying to explain in the book is about the distinction between something that is naturally existing with sentience from the that can trace its origin through perhaps even beyond before the Big Bang, mm-hmm. comparing that to something that is produced artificially. whether that be a robot or a computer or a grey, which actually doesn't have that capacity. And that brings me into actually what I was going to say about these people from SETI talking about sentient machines.
Yeah.
Of course, it's actually a contradiction in terms to have a sentient machine, because to be truly sentient, you have to have awareness. And we, no matter how complicated you make a machine, you can't stick a silicon chip in there called feelings or thoughts or free choice. Just doesn't come out of that machine. So that's something that they don't have. I suppose one way that you could see the connection between the Turing Shroud and this phenomenon that people are describing in terms of UFOs and so on, is if you look at all the actual evidence that does connect the person on the cloth to have been the historical person known as Jesus, that there was a story about him that he was taken by some being or creature and taken to a high point where he could see all the cities of the world, and that they were offered to him, which, of course, the only place you can see all the cities of the world from is from space. So it implies that this whatever it was, this phenomenon that was referred to as the devil, may well have been something like one of these creatures, if you believe the story. Now, it would make sense, really, if the devil is supposed to be something opposite to God, and if God is something that implies absolute absence of all limits and total freedom and full knowledge and awareness, then anything that has sentience to some extent has a reflection of God inside it. So if something's going to be an opposite to him, it's much less likely to be something truly living and aware, but more likely to be something like a machine.
Yes. So the scope, you see, if I may come in, and the scope, yes, you see for these artificial beings is a limited kind of immortality that is purely physical and contrived out of atoms. But my thesis is that we, as human beings, have an ancestry which we can trace back, mum, dad, granddad, great-granddad, and so on, going all the way back to the beginning of the universe, in whatever equivalents there were, as we came down in a cascade to our present form. And that takes us to the entry point of the Big Bang, and obviously by implication beyond too. So the really important thing is, what could there have been before the Big Bang? How does that tie in? And this little piece of cloth, and that's in Palestine with an image on it, I think will actually talk about that mechanism that comes before atoms began, so to speak. And in what and Dr. Silverman delivered a very interesting, groundbreaking speech at a recent symposium in Frascati,
Italy,
where all the scientists, I'm sure you're familiar with that, X, and these guys came together, and he was giving his take, a philosophical take, on what these implications are. And the whole thing comes down to, and it seems a bizarre connection to talk about UFOs and then tie that into the Shroud of Turin.
Yeah.
But I tell you, when you look at this thing in the kind of detail we've had to over the years to make this plausible and to stand up between the empiricists and the spiritual people and so on to bridge that gap, I found a very comfortable line that does that, actually, and gives us a very, very clear perspective that the whole thing seems to be beautifully connected and one. Even though it seems on the surface to be rather, you know, out of kilter, so to speak, it really does make a great deal of sense. And I think that Dr. Silverman is going to talk about, and I'm sure Barry expressed all of this very clearly to everybody, but, you know, there's so much very good research coming through now. The most startling was, of course, some of the stuff done when they dated this thing, and wrongly, it seems, the most recent dating, and Benson and Marino came up with a wonderful and plausible explanation for that. And Barry Schwartz, I think, is also in the middle of this whole kind of melee in trying to make sense of all of this. Andrew wants to come in, I think, again.
Yes, Andrew, go ahead.
I was just going to say that, that was great work that done by Benford and Marino in actually showing that the part of the cloth that was dated was part that was weaved into it afterwards by the nuns. And actually, I'm sure people who have already heard Barry Schwartz talk about the Shroud Hall. There's a great resource of information on his website, which is shroud.com. Now, the thing to me that I was talking about at the Frascati talk is that how did this burst of radiant energy get produced? This is the only hypothesis that the scientists can come up with that can actually account for how this image got on there. But you see, as you may know, the imprint on the cloth is a photographic negative that is only affecting the surface fibers of the cloth and has distance coded information. So it could only have arisen. The only way that we can account for it is by a short burst of intense radiant energy, brighter than the sun, from this dead body of the cloth, the dead body that was wrapped in the cloth. Now, also, of course, the forensic pathology evidence looking at this image shows it to have been a man who had been tortured and crucified. He'd been before that, he'd been whipped by this Roman flagrum. And there are over 100 marks of where he'd been whipped, and there was a cup of sharp objects. The thorns had been placed over his head, and he'd been pierced in the side by a sharp object as well. These are all things that fit in with the historical description of what happened to Jesus. And the question is it just coincidence that the one person in history who has produced a phenomenon like this that we can't reproduce even today with 21st century technology is also the person who has made the most impact in terms of what he taught and how he lived and the example that he showed. And what I was talking about in Frascati was a suggestion to think about how does that relate to this connection, this elusive connection between mind and matter that philosophers and scientists have been pondering all these thousands of years, that a life lived in a certain way might actually change our very atoms such that they could be released into light.
Yeah. Hello?
Nigel?
I hope it's still there.
You're still on there. If Dr. Andrew's listening, if he's still on there, I want to know, what I'm curious to know, did Jesus warn us of the grays in his teaching, Dr. Andrew?
Yes, and that's the most poignant thing of all. You put your finger right on it. There are several accounts, you know, within the texts that really have been thrown out. Mm-hmm. Now, look, I want to make a little statement about a sociological reference to myself and Andrew in a way, which might be slightly relevant to all of this. When I was young, somebody sprinkled some water on me and told me I was a Catholic. When I grew up, I began to know better. I became a kind of have a Christian sense rather than having a tribal mark, so to speak. And I don't believe in organized religion, I have to tell you, but I really do believe in this fantastic icon that produced this amazing thing, probably the greatest single artifact on the earth today in terms of what they're discovering about it. As Andrew says, distance-coded information into a kind of figure on a very dim reddish brown figure on a piece of cloth is highly significant in not just defining the capacity of us humans. Remember, he referred to us humans as gods. In the New Testament, and that is our potential. You see, the real point is he's pointing out something absolutely remarkable in this, in terms of our power as natural derived living being against artificially contrived beings such as robots that are sent out by civilizations with programs to gather particular things or whatever. You program that robot and say, look, mate, look after yourselves at all costs so that you've got to be there to do our research for us. But then you've got to define what is the difference between the creators that might be naturally contrived out of a line through the universe, so to speak, and what an artificial thing is. And you cannot program. There's a built-in paradox. You cannot tell a robot what it is because it has no identity, has no sense of I, if you see what I'm trying to say. And so the problem is the robot is likely therefore to see that the person who actually built it is enemy number one, and in terms of preserving itself, you know, against the dictum, be there at all costs, look after all dangers to you, it's likely to see that you are the greatest danger, rather the creators of greatest danger that can pull the plug on it. And therefore, what's going to happen. The robot, if it's given power and intelligence, artificial intelligence albeit, will try to take you out. And that's the real problem. Maybe when you make robots, and that's the lesson, do not make artificially intelligent robots. And what do you think we are doing here on this planet? Exactly that. And that is a great lesson we have to learn. So going back to this business about, you know, affirmations, there are several accounts within the text, for instance, of the Coptic Gnostic Library. And in my research, I had to be extremely thorough, extremely neutral, and extremely objective, not go just simply for the Christianesque thesis. I had to look at this in all kinds of perspectives, and I looked really for the things that were thrown out by the so-called fathers of the church.
What did you find, Nigel?
And that's where you find the real truth.
This is what I'm telling you. Please.
Hi?
Please. I'm very curious. Yeah.
Sorry. So these guys were really a bit nervous about all the stuff that they were getting in terms of what was reported by Christ. And so the Coptic Gnostic Library, in which Jesus actually carefully explains to his apostles exactly how to deal with alien beings should they be faced with them. Most notably of these explanations, you know, is one that was given in the first Apocalypse of James in what they call the Nag Hammadi Codex. You know, and that was, if you recall, and I'm sure there are people who would in California know about this Nag Hammadi Codex, at least mm-hmm. some of them might, where jars were discovered in a cave by an Arab shepherd, and in that were scrolls that were actually a depiction of the actual Gospels in a much more complete version. This Nag Hammadi Codex actually lists Jesus warning James about entities that take away souls by theft. He then tells him that the way to deal with such entities is to be as like as possible to the state of pre-existence, i.e. the state before the existence of the physical universe. So you see, X, a very fascinating and interesting series of correlations brings the things we take in spiritual context through, shall we say broadly, religion, into the frame of reference with what we see in terms of flying discs that go across the sky and pure technology in terms of the most advanced you possibly can get in hard science, i.e. physics and biochemistry and biology and so on. And that's the great thing that jumped up at me while I was looking at the research and prompted me to write a series, in fact, of three books, of which the one you talk about is the second one. The third one is just completed and will be published when all the hoo-ha and the controversy that this second one is raising has died down a bit, you know?
Well, Nigel, let me ask you. You have a very good point. I see where you're going with this, but you can also see how a lot of people may going to have a huge problem with you on this in respect that what is the difference between what you're saying in your book and saying, well, these entities are demons, are demonic, possessed, stealing your soul?
The demonic, the demons of old, and all this business about these heebie-jeebies or whatever you like to call, that's a nice English word for describing all these manifestations, and ghosts and so on. Ghosts are something quite different, by the way. When you talk about demons and all the rest of it, I do believe that the power of these things, which have existed on the earth for many hundreds of thousands of years, you know, mm-hmm. they have been trying to breed a kind of physicality that they could piggyback on, because they realized, and this is the crucial point, X, that maybe with a natural derived living form like ours that can live and die, and perhaps, as many of the great religions once accepted, reincarnate again, that they had a mechanism for a almost eternal future rather than a temporal one, so to speak. And maybe the robot, i.e. Pinocchio, tried to become a little boy and is trying to become a little boy through that by developing a species like ours to have a suitable DNA that they could actually synthesize with their version of DNA, make a compromise, and therefore have their mind quantum, their artificial intelligent mind quantum, downloaded into our scheme of mentality or whatever it is, and make a combination which would then give them the propensity to actually continue on. I believe that the whole thing can to be there in reverse is it's a technological phenomenon would have been viewed by the people of the past as magical, for instance. So yeah. The demons and goblins of the past could have been the greys of today, you know, but reported as metaphysical creations because those who witnessed them had no reference, you know, against which to describe the technological features that was seen, if you see what I'm trying to say.
I do.
So there's a great confusion here that these kinds of, you know, demons and manifestations and so on may have been seen as something extraordinary. Well, of course it would be extraordinary if it came from a technology that's persisted on this planet maybe for a million years or maybe more. We don't know exactly how much.
But
we can define a definite path from maybe 200,000 years ago when they created from a hominid form that was on the Earth a kind of capacity to admit a huge brain quite suddenly with the ability, and this is the crucial thing, to have a pelvis that would actually move this larger form of brain through it and give birth to a bigger type of human being, a kind of more intelligent type of
Nigel,
human
are they
being.
Nigel, are they all benevolent, or are some of them all malevolent, or how exactly are they? Are there different classifications? You said there's up to 100,000. You know, there's 100,000 different planets, planetary systems out there being discovered. So obviously there could be different races, like there is here. There's white
again,
people.
Again, X2, you put your finger on it again. I'm very impressed by the way you go from vital point to vital point. You're quite right. Now, when you look at this particular thing, you've got to ask the question: Why are these things moving against us in such a covert form? Why do they do what they do with such guile and with such apparent cruelty? Because when you talk to these abductees, the impression you really get from many of them is that the suffering they've gone through, and of course some of them, you know, live through this suffering all their lives. Now, I hope to make this point later on and to say why these abductees might be abducted in the first place, why
Please.
Particularly them. However, the point about it is when these things move into that mind space of a human being, they're doing it for their own benefit. They're actually exploring something that is so powerful in terms of our future, if you see, in our own terms of reference, so to speak, that one has to ask the question, why would they want to do this? I think, as I said, they want the capacity for what I call soul. And to me, a soul is simply an information line that comes in a derivational stance all the way down from a beginning, perhaps beyond the universe. So each one of us has a unique line of information, and that this information is what they are seeking. In order to do that, they would have to treat us as any superior species would do a less sophisticated one in a kind of, you know, dismissive way, like a lab rat, if you like. You know,
they would
see us as things that they can manipulate, and from a hidden stance, just as a lab rat doesn't know the chap in the white overalls is going to stick needles in him and probably take his life in the end.
Yeah.
But he's really well looked after and fed and so on. But until the point that his own capacity, I mean the rat's capacity, is used for the purposes of someone that controls that rat, if you see what I'm trying to say.
I do.
You know, the reason I'm making these points in these books is quite simply to warn humankind that there are sources in this world that are taking these things seriously for their own purposes, and the rest of us are kept in the dark about it. Andrew, I think, wants to come in here.
Andrew, please, go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can, loud and clear, Andrew. Go ahead.
Okay, excellent. I was just earlier talking about the Turin Shroud.
Please.
And about the image upon it, and about how that was... It must have been caused by a short, intense burst of radiant energy. And I was saying that I had been very inspired by something I read in a manuscript of a book that Nigel actually wrote couple of decades ago or more, talking about the connection between mind and matter. And in this, he was talking about how to understand the connection, you have to really see it as a continuum, rather than mind being something that happens to happen by chance, by a certain arrangement of atoms to make brain cells, that it's actually the other way around, that matter is a product of mind. And this is actually something that quantum theory does really confirm, because the observer has to be there to make the observed real. The electron is just a potential, it's just a possibility for something until mind comes into the equation. So I was looking at that, and I was looking at what the original people in quantum theory had said, and I won't go into too much detail to bore the listeners about it, but it was Schrödinger, the famous one who, you know, people will have heard of Schrödinger's cat and so on. He came up with the wave equation, which is one of the most accurate things that has ever been found by science. And he was saying...
Nigel, are you there? Dr. Andrew Silverman, Nigel Kern, are you there? You gotta love live talk radio, ladies and gentlemen. It happens sometimes. We gotta cut the program short for the night, guys. Gotta finish up now. For more of Nigel's work, it's www.nigelkerner.com. Wonderful program. I want to have Nigel back on the show. Let me see if I could close this properly. Nigel, are you there?
Yes.
Nigel, Dr. Andrew Silverman, I really thank you both. I know we're getting cut up. I got to end the program now. I thank you both so much for coming on. Nigel, when your third book has gone through publishing in the new year, I'd like to have you come back on with Dr. Andrew Silverman, and we will continue this where we left off. You have my word.
It'll be a privilege.
It'll be my honor. I'm sorry. Because we started the program a little bit late, we got to end it a little bit earlier.
No problem.
Thank you very much, both you gentlemen, for being on Extract Radio.
Okay, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.